Okay, they say you can't advance unless you learn from the past. Well, we would love to learn more from the past if only the controllers would allow us to do what we do best, which is really that of a very inquisitive species. But the past is locked away and hidden from us. It is left to the devices and the drive of a few independent and very talented researchers to go back into these ruins and try to piece it together and tell us what was going on in the past, what kinds of technologies, what kinds of religions, what kinds of philosophies, what their social structure was like. And ultimately, of course, if we could do that, we just might be able to learn a little bit about what we're doing so wrong this time. Brian Forster is one of the world's premier researchers, and he has spent many years looking into the past and has just come back from a trip to Egypt. And I thought it might be kind of fun to talk to Brian tonight about that in this hour. He went back and spent time with Stephen Mailer, our friend and colleague of many, many years. Are you there, Brian?
Yes, sir.
Boy, you sound like you're right next door. Where are you? You still down in South America?
I'm in Lima, Peru.
That last time I looked, that was South America. So you went to Egypt with Stephen and survived.
I did, and also with Christopher Dunn.
The best. The best. Those two are amazing. I can't even imagine what it must have been like. You, no doubt, and how many people were on this tour?
42 guests.
Great. Okay. For all of those who went, they went on a once-in-a-lifetime trip. For people like Brian Forster, they can go back again. Stephen and Chris, of course, will go back again. But those who went for the first time, I'm sure, Brian, got to see things that no other tourist would likely ever get to encounter.
Well, quite definitely, because we saw obvious signs of lost ancient technology. It was really so obvious. It was I was astounded at how much we were able to see, even in the first half hour on the Giza Plateau.
You hit the floor running. Okay,
yeah.
So you're on the Giza Plateau. You got 42 people there. Chris and Stephen are leading the way. You are eminently qualified to go there and absorb as much as anybody could from an experience like that. Tell us what you saw in the first half hour. What was it like?
Well, I was in complete awe of being right next to the Great Pyramid, because most of my work has been in Peru and Bolivia, and the structures are quite large here, but to be on the Giza Plateau was mind-boggling. And having read Chris's two books, The Giza Power Plant and also Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, I had seen photographs and videos of ancient saw cuts, drill holes, and things like that. But within half an hour, we were literally stumbling over examples of that.
Ancient saw cuts and drill holes. Now, allegedly, at the time the Great Pyramid was constructed, and certainly most of the monuments of Giza and elsewhere, the Egyptian people were still stuck in the Bronze Age, or very nearly in the Bronze Age, weren't they?
Well, according to the archaeological record, the most sophisticated tools that the dynastic Egyptians had were bronze chisels and stone hammers.
Right. It's amazing what you can do with a bronze chisel and a stone hammer, isn't it?
Not too much, no.
I mean, you look at these things, and it is said that even today, if we wanted to build something like the Great Pyramid, we would be very hard-pressed to do it. It certainly could be done over time. But the precision of these enormous blocks, as Chris Dunn has talked about on this program and does so well in his books, the actual measurements are mind-boggling. The tolerances are so tiny. And you got to see this. That must have been really exciting. When you say saws, what comes to mind? What came to mind when you were there, Brian, looking at saw marks on enormous blocks? And I would imagine these were also seen at quarry sites.
Well, the thing is that the first things we were looking at were giant basalt blocks. And basalt is a very hard volcanic stone.
Correct.
So more or less you would need, I think, a diamond saw to cut that. So we saw obvious grooves that had been cut by what looked like very large circular saws. And you could even see a bit of the wavering that the saw would have made, because the blade would have been very thin.
Uh-huh.
But they were, yeah, they were literally all over the place. And of course, it's something that Stephen and Chris would point out, but the average tour guide wouldn't even know that they existed.
Now, this is interesting because a massive, large tool like that, we're not talking about a table saw here. We're talking about something much bigger. And a circular saw, just the presence of the artifact of lines made in basalt by a circular saw would literally blow out the door the traditional idea of how the monuments were created, wouldn't it?
Well, most definitely.
Now, if the Egyptians were admitted to have had circular saws to construct these monuments, that would turn everything that is commonly taught about ancient Egypt really on its ear. It would. We would have to give them that they were able to invent advanced, obviously driven by some energy source. What would that be? Electricity? Who knows?
Well, yeah, one would think it would have to be electricity, but also when you look really carefully at the pattern that the saw was making, it was moving through the stone quite quickly. So it's not as though it would have been something hand-driven. This would have had to have been a controlled machine of some kind.
Sure.
Yeah.
No way a hand tool could do that. Not a chance. No hand driving, no 10 men on a bicycle type device making it go round and round. It just doesn't happen. This idea of a circular saw in ancient Egypt just blows the whole scam away. Oh, that's amazing. And you say the evidence would suggest that these saw blades were moving through the rock quickly. I wonder what we have today that could do the same thing. Was that discussed at all? Or might be able to duplicate that? Now, you move a blade through a piece of basalt like that quickly, you've got a heck of a piece of machinery.
Yeah, as far as I know, you would have to have diamond tip saw blades. And some of these were meters in diameter, the blade itself.
Wait. Meters in diameter. You're talking about a saw blade 10, 12 feet in diameter from side to side?
I would think conservatively, but also we were able to see where the saw cut ended. And so the thickness of the blade looked like it would be smaller than an eighth of an inch. So you're talking about a very thin blade, and that would, you know, constructing a blade like that by itself would
we
have taken...
We couldn't do it today. I bet you we couldn't do it. Not
well,
something that big. Let's say 12 feet, just for fun. You lay the blade, circular blade, down on the ground. It's 12 feet from side to side. That's the diameter of it. An eighth of an inch thick. You could pick that up and almost flex it like a piece of sheet metal.
Well, the interesting thing is that at other sites, aside from the Giza Plateau, we saw similar cuts, and you could see where the blade wavered because of the thinness of the blade. So it wasn't necessarily a perfectly straight cut, but you could see the wave pattern that it created, and the spacing between each pass of the blade was very consistent.
Uh-huh.
So again, that would suggest that it was under, under power and not, you know, hand power that would waver
well, of course.
Back and forth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Sure. All right. So you've got a blade, let's just say 12 feet, might have been bigger, that can cut through basalt like a knife through butter, but close to it. Fast enough to make these enormous blocks and other shapes and sizes of basalt and another heavy rock. I guess cut almost anything with it. I again go back to a question, and I wish Chris were here. I'd ask him. He may be listening. Could we make a blade like that today at an eighth of an inch thick that could cut through basalt? And if so, how big would the device that would hold and drive a blade like that have to be? A 12-foot, 14-foot in diameter blade. Again, take a ruler out, folks, and look at that. An eighth of an inch thick. That's absurdly small. This is really a very interesting story.
Well, you'd also have to take into account the amount of horsepower that it would take to drive and control the bearings that would be involved to keep the blade, spinning smoothly,
Absolutely.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Oh,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah. No, this is, again, something. I mean, if we have such a thing, I've never seen it. Maybe we do. Any evidence of any other type of cutting You talked about drill holes. We'll get to that in a minute. Some people have suggested that perhaps some laser cutting tools or some other kind of energy devices might have been used. But you come away with the feeling that there were big circular saws there, and that's how they did it.
To a great extent, yeah. But the drills, the drill holes were very common, and router-like machines seemed to be quite common.
To do edging work.
To do edging work and also grooves in granite and basalt and other hard stone.
Incredible what those people did with those little bronze hammers and chisels. Just incredible. All right. Brian Forster is with us this hour. We'll be right back in a couple minutes. Hang on. Just came back from a trip to Egypt, the Giza Plateau, and other areas with Stephen Mailer and Chris Dunn. This is amazing. Okay, so we're not allowed to admit that the ancient Egyptians had this highly advanced, extremely intelligently designed and built, and highly effective machinery to cut through these enormous blocks of very dense and very thick and stubborn rock. But they also had drills, power drills of some kind. Tell us more about these drill holes.
Well, the drill holes most commonly looked like they were tube drills, and that what that means is that they were hollow. And so they were able to take a core out, much like, I think, in modern terms, the way that dynamite holes are produced. And so we were able to see many examples of that. Diameter drill holes 3 or 4 inches, and when you looked on the inside again, you could see that the thickness of the tube, which one would suppose would be diamond encrusted, was again less than 1/8 of an inch thick. So these would more likely be drill presses than handheld drills.
A drill press. Tell our listeners who may not know what a drill press is.
Okay, well, most people are acquainted with a hand electric drill, which you hold and you try to stabilize with both hands to drive the drill bit straight. What a drill press does is that it's a fixed system, so it controls the movement left to right and up and down in order to create a really nice smooth entrance. And so because these drill holes that we saw were so even, it would implicate that these were drill presses rather than hand drills that were used.
Okay, how would a drill press be affixed to a piece of rock to drill sideways or any other angle? I don't quite get that. They'd almost have to be portable, and then they have to be somehow, unless the rock was situated in such a way that it was completely flat and the drill press was perpendicular to the ground, it wouldn't want to drill too well.
Yeah, that's right. What you would have is you'd have a stabilizing apparatus that would either sit on top of or be affixed to the stone itself. But the thing is, in most cases where we found the drill holes, the surface of the stone was very flat anyway, so that would make it easy for such a device to be used.
All right, tell me more. So we've got two things that completely can't be, but obviously were, and are not allowed to be talked about. The cover-up continues. These two things, even one of them, would again completely destroy contemporary ancient Egypt in the school textbooks. It would just take it apart.
Well, another example is on the first day we walked past the Sphinx, and there are two buildings in front of the Sphinx. One is called the Valley Temple, and the other is called the Sphinx Temple. And in the Valley Temple, Chris was there, Chris Dunn, and he had a precision ruler made out of very hard steel that he uses in the high-end manufacturing industry. It was about a foot long, and as he put it, as he put it onto the flat surface of this one stone, he was able to estimate that the flatness of that stone over 12 inches of length was at least as accurate as 2/10,000ths of an inch.
Okay. Do we achieve such exquisite shaping and refining and kind of, well, I don't know what you'd call it, rock working? Can we do that today?
Well, we can, because you can see even in some people's kitchens and bathrooms where they'll have like a granite countertop. So we do have machines that can shape and polish surfaces like that.
Yeah, it was almost a rhetorical question, but okay.
Yeah, exactly.
but the idea of the Egyptians doing this with chisels and mallets is okay.
No, because most of the portrayals are with you know, a slave with a stone ball pounding away at the surface. And that of course is even the way they depict the giant obelisks that were made.
Do you still see this over there? I mean, do they still try to represent in drawings or illustrations in Egypt at the tourist locations how these amazing monuments were created, and do they show such a thing?
Oh, they do, and it's not just there. You also see it in Peru and other places where you find megalithic structures. The depictions are of, you know, often people in loincloths with some kind of stone in their hand pounding away at the surface, and as if that's going to create the accuracy that we're talking about.
Well, it's simply impossible.
It is.
So it's a laugh. It's a joke. The whole idea of ancient Egypt as it is taught today, and I've discussed this over the years with Stephen and others, is absurd. It's a lie. It's actually a very insulting lie. It's just, it's ridiculous.
Definitely. It's an insult to the ancient people who did this work, and it's an insult to the people who come to look at these monuments.
All right, well, you were probably laughing more than you were feeling insulted. Tell me more about what you saw.
Well, actually, I think the most important thing is that we saw, you know, beautiful and incredible buildings that the dynastic Egyptians built. And the dynastic Egyptians are what most people think of when they think of ancient Egypt, starting about 2500 BC. So we saw very large buildings with huge columns. But the key thing is that almost everything made by the dynastic Egyptians was made out of limestone, which is quite a soft,
very soft
material.
Yeah.
But when we were looking at the machine surfaces in general, that was basalt, calcite, granite, and diorite. And those materials, A, are much harder, and B, they're not found locally. Limestone is found all over the Giza Plateau and area, but most of these other materials, and some weighing many, many, many tons, had to be brought in from 500 miles away, if not farther away than that.
Well, that's those guys in loincloths with ropes, right?
Yeah, and tree trunks dragging them across the sand.
Yeah, they keep running ahead with the tree trunk as it comes out the back of the block and putting... That's just amazing. The whole thing, how the authorities have gotten away with this absurd lie for so long is kind of amazing in and of itself. All right, you are putting up a number of new videos. We'll talk about those when we come back. Stephen Mailer is featured in a number of them. Brian Forrester is with us. We'll be back in just a couple minutes. back with Brian Forster. His website, to click on his name and guests at rents.com, hiddeninkavideos.com, hiddeninkavideos.com. All of your Egyptian videos are up there now, Brian, are they?
Yeah, I've got about 8 up so far, and I'll have at least 20 more because I was filming every day. I was just so blown away by what I was looking at.
Great. Yeah, I was just looking at one by Stephen, or with Stephen Mailer, Ancient Electricity. And he raises the question, was electricity just simply reinvented? I think the answer is pretty obvious. Yeah, something. If it wasn't electricity, it was something very similar to it. There are carvings that quite clearly show a very wondrous kind of an object, long, kind of a tapered tube, as it were, with a serpent inside, representative of some kind of energy. And this is clearly a giveaway. There are so many things to look at. So there are 8 videos up there now at hiddeninkavideos.com. Go enjoy. This is a trip just completed with Brian and Stephen Mailer and Chris Dunn and a bunch of other folks. And you'll be able to just almost go there yourself. So, okay, we know the capstones on the Great Pyramid were limestone, soft, easy to work with relatively, although an enormous undertaking to do that. And when that pyramid was capped, it had to have been just as stunning as it is now. It must have been an order of magnitude more stunning. Okay, who cut the basalt? Who cut the heavier duty rocks? What are your thoughts on that? What did you learn from Chris and Stephen?
Well, I think the basic thing we're looking at is that there was a very advanced culture that existed before the dynastic Egyptians, which Stephen and the Awiyan family refer to as the Kemetians. And these people lived thousands of years before the dynastic Egyptians, and the dynastic Egyptians, as in the pharaohs, simply inherited the locations and the monuments of their predecessors.
Right.
And they added, you know, they added buildings, etc. A really good example of that are some of the surfaces that are carved with hieroglyphs. The quality of the hieroglyph is very inferior to the surface itself. And the classic example of that is a place called the Serapeum, which is this underground place that was only reopened about 6 months ago.
Uh-huh.
And in there, you have these monstrous boxes, more than 20 of them. The boxes weigh at least 60 tons each, and the lids weigh at least 10 tons each.
Mm-hmm.
And the hieroglyphics are almost like childish
graffiti.
Scribbling. Yeah, compared to the incredible precision surfaces.
And there's no way to move boxes in and out of there with equipment even that we have now. It would be almost impossible. There's nowhere to room or maneuver in those rooms. You can't lift. You can't turn corners like that. So it's highly suggestive that these boxes were somehow levitated and rolled in there. Not rolled, but rolled in without actually rolling. Pushed in. Something moves them. I mean, we've seen pictures of these. Stephen's brought them to the program before, and they are stunning.
Yeah.
Do you have a video up on that yet?
Not yet. That's coming up. But the surfaces are so flat and so highly polished that you can almost see your face in them. They're
right.
You know, it's quite a surreal experience to go into the Serapeum.
Okay. Next, we've talked about energy, we've talked about tools. No question that they had advanced tools, they being the pre-dynastic civilization that inherited that location and did most of the work. Then along came the Egyptians. Whatever happened to the Kemetians, we don't know. But somebody did this before. Was there any talk about the Kemetians having picked up technology from the remnants of Atlantis, perhaps?
Well, according to the Kemetian tradition, Kemet, which is the ancient name for Egypt, existed as a very sophisticated society long before Atlantis would have even existed.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, according to, you know, to what I learned is that the Kemetians basically Their civilization ended at the end of the Ice Age, because the end of the Ice Age was an incredibly traumatic event that could have had global implications in terms of catastrophes. Mm-hmm. With the oceans rose by 350 feet. The axis of the Earth may have changed. The weather patterns would have changed, and so that seems to have been the termination of them. But according to Stephen and the great teacher Abdel Hakim Awiyan, the Cometians may have existed as far back as 60,000 years.
Okay, all right, makes sense. Yeah, I had the great honor, and Stephen, if you're listening, I know you probably are. Stephen brought Hakim on the program once, and we had a priceless visit. He was a man out of time, as they say. Just an extraordinary human being. Did you ever have a chance to meet him?
No, I didn't, but I was very fortunate that his son Yusuf and wife Patricia and the entire family of the Awiyans, we spent a lot of time with them. Yusuf and Patricia were in charge of the tour, and many of the other family members were. So they have all learned a lot from their great father.
Yeah, he indeed was that. Okay, tell us some more. We've got a little bit of time left here. I want you to be able to touch on as many of the highlights as you can. Thank you very much on behalf of an awful lot of people for undertaking to videotape or to record in digital format your trip and to put all these videos up. This is going to be a great library of really wonderful experience, so I thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Well, the thing is, we during the 3 weeks that we were there, we went all the way from Alexandria, you know, which is on the Mediterranean, all the way up to Aswan, which is, of course, where the Aswan High Dam is. And so we stopped at many sites. And again, we saw many beautiful dynastic works. But what intrigued me the most was the area more or less around Giza, a little bit north of Giza, a little bit south, which is called and is the title of one of Stephen's books, The Land of Osiris.
Okay, we'll touch on that in just a minute. As we continue with Brian Forster, I'm looking at Osirion, or Osirion, Osirion, is the second video up there. Is that what we're kind of talking about here?
Yeah.
Okay, very good. Again, if you go to Brian's website, hiddeninkavideos.com, the first eight are up there now, and time well spent, I'm sure. I look forward to having some time, something I don't have much of, to be able to look at as many of these as I can, and I will do so. Back in just a couple minutes. Egypt with Stephen Mailer and Chris Dunn. I'm sure Stephen has another tour in the works here some months down the road, probably this fall, I don't know. But if any of you can go, it's obviously going to be, again, a more than memorable experience. All right, Brian, we have one segment left. Where do you want to take us next?
Well, actually, you mentioned the Osirion, and that's one thing, that's one place that really blew me away, because it was almost like from a science fiction set. The thing is that...
How so?
Well, it's just again, we were looking at a lot of dynastic buildings, which were very well made. And at the site where the Osirion is, you walk through this very large temple, and you see all the hieroglyphs and etc. And then you walk up a set of stairs onto the ground outside, and then walk another 100 feet or so, and you look down into the Osirion, because it is at least 20 feet underground. It was, up until quite recently, I think, buried in sand, and so The funny thing, or comical, or sad thing, is that most of the Egyptologists say that the dynastic building and the Osirion were built at the same time. But the Osirion is made out of solid granite blocks, weighing at least 60 tons each. And again, it's 20 feet lower than the other building. And so it's just screaming at you that it's much, much more ancient than the dynastic buildings around it.
Any saw marks or drill holes?
We weren't able to get right up close to it because there's water percolating at the surface. But even just from a distance, Chris Dunn conservatively estimated that the average size of the blocks was 67 tons, I think. Stephen and I think they're more like 100 tons. But a very simple, almost Lego system of mega building out of rose granite. And that stone had to have been brought from the Aswan area. So, again, you're talking 60 to 100 ton blocks being moved across the desert, hundreds of miles.
It may not have been a desert back then. We don't know.
Well, exactly.
We don't know what the climate was like. We can guess. It's sand. Osirion has been covered with sand, I guess, to a large degree, and excavated. And one of your videos deals with that. So I'm rolling the video right now, taking a look at it. And again, if you want to just look at these, you can go to hiddeninkavideos.com. Very simple. Okay.
Well, another point is the fact that the Sphinx, which of course everybody on the planet more or less has probably seen by now, Dr. Robert Schock and others have proven that it was carved. It wasn't like hacked out of the limestone bedrock. In order to extract the Sphinx or make the shape of it, multi-ton blocks of limestone had to be removed, and from those blocks, the Sphinx Temple was made, and based on the erosion, Robert Schock has proven
on the Sphinx itself
that rain had to have been what caused the weathering, and that dates the Sphinx at least 8,000 years old. So the climate was very different 8,000 to 10,000 years ago. It was much wetter in that area than it is now.
Okay, I've got the Osirion video rolling, and the excavation shows in the ground square pillars, and I don't know what the bottom looks like, but what do you think that this is? It obviously is some kind of an entry. There are, I can see three what appear to be walk-in entries down in there. Where do they lead to? What's inside there?
Well, that's the problem, because you're not allowed to access them. And, the whole mystery about that area is what were these incredible structures built for? According to, Chris's Dunn's theory of the Giza power plant, the original constructions there were part of a massive energetic system, which would have produced electricity, probably based on using water, not necessarily from the present Nile, but from the older Nile, which was farther to the west. And so that water would have entered through a whole series of chambers and tunnels, and would have been broken down into hydrogen and oxygen to produce various forms of energy.
So we'll call them doorways that I'm seeing now. You were not allowed to walk over and into those.
No.
You should have snuck over.
Oh, well, if the guards hadn't been there. But the fun thing was that my last day in Egypt, I got to walk with Yusuf Awiyan, who is Hakim's son.
Yes.
And he showed me that there are at least three levels of tunnels under the Giza Plateau. So it's a crisscrossing system of tunnels and shafts, which were meticulously made, and later were used as as open areas for tombs for the dynastic Egyptians.
By later peoples, that's important.
Exactly.
The bronze mallet and chisel people.
Yeah.
Gosh, this is just amazing. These videos are really extraordinary.
Oh, thank you.
Okay, Osirion, that's one of the videos you can take a look at, and you see the excavation. The upper levels of sand at the top of what I'm looking at, that marks the boundary of the excavation, it looks like. And they dug down, looks like 10 feet at least, and then worked over and then went another at least 20 to get this this particular structure or edifice exposed. And it is, it looks like it's in very good condition. It looks like it has been preserved very well by time, of course, having been held at bay by the sands. What is the floor in there like? It looks almost like a greenish. What is what's the bottom?
Well, it's greenish because of the percolating water that's coming up, and so that's probably algae. But
that's
the most
water
obvious,
table down there. Okay.
Yeah, the most obvious thing that we saw was you see layer upon layer of civilization. The most recent, more or less, being the Roman period and the Christian period. And of course the Islam after that, but the farther back in time you go, the larger the blocks, the higher the level of precision, and the more exotic materials. Again, the hard stone was brought in from hundreds of miles away, minimum, in some cases much farther.
So those large blocks I'm seeing are not indigenous to the area at all.
No, they're from the Aswan area because that's where the rose granite comes from.
You know, people always say the most obvious thing. Well, if they had all these tools and they had all these transport devices, where are they? Well, time does things. And 10,000 years from now, if we stopped, there wouldn't be much left to prove we were here. And that's a fact.
Yeah, well, also, of course, culture after culture, if they didn't understand what these machines were, they would simply have recycled them. So anything made of gold or silver or anything else would have been stripped off. And so over time, it's like how long does an abandoned car just sit there without people stripping, you know, the tires and other things off?
Well, ever restored a 40 or 50 year old car that's basically rust? Another 50 years and there'd be nothing left.
Yeah.
It goes back. Nature reclaims its own.
That's true.
Wow, this is a very, very exciting video, Osirion. I wonder who knew how to dig there. Interesting. We also have technology now that, of course, can overfly any area, ground-penetrating tomography, and pretty much tell the people in the pentagram what's down there. So we know. Zahi knew what was basically under much of the plateau. This is not a secret anymore. That's what led to so much looting. They knew where to dig.
Yeah, that's true. And also the thing is that there are some incredible sites which are still within the fencing of military bases. For example, the Bent Pyramid, which we got to see recently, or I think maybe less than 10 years ago, was inaccessible because it was part of a military base. But as far as I can tell, Stephen estimates that probably 80% of the ancient complexes are still under the sand. It's just resources have not been put into place in order to excavate them.
Well, as I said at the beginning of the hour, we know so little about these things, and they're so incredibly important. And history, as we are being taught it, is such a lie. It's, you know, I could laugh at it, but it's pathetic. We have a birthright to know all this stuff, and those who are keeping it from us are about as bad as it gets.
Well, that's why it's so wonderful to to have the opportunity to be with Chris Dunn, Stephen Mailer, and also we had other engineers with us as guests, and their eyes were wide open looking at this stuff. So the more that we can disseminate the information, the more that people go to visit Egypt and look at these with a fresh look, not the boring typical history, but the real story, then the more that we can reclaim our humanity.
What you're saying is the vast majority of tourists who do visit the Giza Plateau are lied to.
Well, and the same thing in Peru. That's the same thing.
We just have a minute left.
Yeah.
Brian Forster, how would you compare the relics and remains of great works in Peru with what you saw on the Giza Plateau?
Well, I would say that they're equally as impressive, but whoever the great builders were in Peru, I don't think were the same as the builders in Egypt, because in Peru, there are megalithic structures with incredible accuracy. You can't fit a human hair in between multi-ton blocks, but we can't see very much of actual tool marks, and so I don't think it was the same ancient culture, but it could have been done at the same time, like 10, 12, or even more thousand years ago.
All right, well, it's great to talk to you again, Brian. When you get all these videos uploaded, let me know. We'll have you back on, and Stephen, why don't you come back on with Chris very soon, and we'll talk about these things, get some more photos set up, and take people on tours. And speaking of tours, we'll find out when your next tour is as well. Brian, thank you for being here. This has been really a lot of fun. I've learned and greatly enjoyed it.
Always my pleasure, Jeff. Thank you.
All right, be well.
You too.
Okay, and thank you, Alvin Sock. All right, we'll be right back in a few.